I'm on a little plateau at the base of Iskaros Mountain, a low peak in far northern Norway, outside the town of Karasjok, about 1,000 kilometers as the crow flies from Trondheim, and far above the Arctic Circle. Getting to here from town requires an hour-long drive on rough dirt roads, and then another hour's hike over a low ridge to where I am now. It's early June and quite windy and chilly. There aren't a ton of trees here, just stunted birches with wispy little leaves that are so small, they look like they're not sure if they want to open up in the weak sun. In front of me is a weird, bumpy depression filled with a crazy quilt of open water, grassy bits, and little hillocks made out of peat. These little hills are called pulsas, and inside them, there's a core of ice. Some of them are dry on the top and cracked open, wide open, like a crusty boil that is split. And wandering around, out in this mix of freezing water, bottomless mud, and wet peat, is a young man wearing a pair of chest waders. He's carrying a trowel and a bag filled with tea bags.
Lipton tea bags. Green tea and rooibos, exactly. I'm Daniel Angulo Serrano.
And he's burying these tea bags. Lots of them. And how many bags will you bury?
100, more or less. Probably a little bit more.
How many have you buried so far?
Now? Yeah, 90 something probably. I will have to look at my Excel, but yeah, I have done almost all the work.
I can say with certainty that Daniel is not testing new ways to brew tea. Instead, his efforts are part of a larger study where a team of researchers is trying to solve the riddle of how global warming is affecting this landscape, and how those changes in turn might actually amplify future warming. I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you're listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Today, I'm going to take you out in the field with this team to hear what they're finding out about thawing permafrost and greenhouse gases. Because the pulsas, those bumpy hillocks, are a special kind of landform that only occurs in bogs where there is permafrost, or permanently frozen ground. And it turns out that they may hold the key to understanding just how hot our planet may get. Global warming over the past few decades has meant that more and more permafrost has thawed. In fact, the Arctic is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the global average. And when permafrost thaws, microbes get to work on all the organic matter that's previously been frozen solid. These microbes release carbon dioxide and methane, both of which are greenhouse gases, heating up the planet. But how much? How fast? How long? Is this good news for the planet, or bad, or both? These questions matter because there's a lot of permafrost. By some estimates, it's found in as much as 25% of the Northern Hemisphere. And locked up in that frozen, partially decomposed peat is an estimated 1,460 to 1,600 gigatons of carbon. That's almost twice the amount already in the atmosphere. In layperson's terms, it's a lot. But more than just telling you what the researchers are finding, I also wanted to let you in on just what it takes for them to find these kinds of answers. That's why I've traveled all this way, to look over the shoulders of the team here, out on this cold, windy Arctic plateau. I think it's fascinating how scientists have to find indirect ways to get the answers to the big questions they're trying to ask. They're like detectives at the scene of a crime, working with witnesses that can't really talk, and trying to reconstruct what has happened. Not only do they need to figure out how to ask questions of mute witnesses, they need a kind of time machine. Especially when it comes to global warming, they need to be able to look into the future to tell us, as best they can, how things actually will change. And part of that answer is yes, in the tea bags.
I think it's important to realize that permafrost, actually intact permafrost, has a, we call it a carbon sink, which means that it actually takes up carbon out of the air and like stores it in the ground. My name is Lisa van Solt. I'm from the Netherlands and I am currently doing my master's conservation and restoration ecology at the Radboud University in Nijmegen, which is in the Netherlands.
Lisa is one of the researchers working with Hanna Lee, an associate professor in biology at NTNU. Hanna is head of the team that I've joined for this visit to the field site.
And because it's frozen, the microbial community cannot access it and not like digest it, so it will not be produced into methane or CO2. And due to temperature increase, it's actually becoming a possible source. So it means that it's not only increasing the emissions it already had, it's actually like doubling down on it. I think that's why it's way, like, it's a very important thing. And also permafrost is very big. Like, it's the entire top of the world and like some in the Alps. For example, if all of that sink would become a source, that's like, yeah, we're done. It's over. Then, and the 2 degrees will never make it anymore.
To figure out what's happening with CO2 and other greenhouse gases, the researchers need to find ways to trap and measure the emissions from the permafrost that's thawing right now. Hanna explains.
In the beginning of my study, maybe like 15 years ago, then we only thought about carbon emissions as CO2. But during the course of our study, then we realized there's actually this changes in landscape feature is leading to methane emissions. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas.
We all know that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but methane, which is produced by microbes digesting rotting plants and famously burping cows, is 30 times more potent than CO2 when it comes to warming the planet. Scientists make computer models, which they use to help policymakers see what could happen to the planet under existing greenhouse gas emissions and how temperatures could change as we hopefully reduce emissions. But as Hanna said, permafrost is still a big question mark.
We have some estimates of how much we humans can emit. But something that is not counted in this estimation of how much we can emit are some of these natural emissions. So greenhouse gas emissions from permafrost thawing, that's part of natural emissions. And that's not counted in how much can we emit in order to reach 1.5 degrees at the end of the century.
The models are important in figuring out our carbon budget. A carbon budget is just what it sounds like. But instead of having money to spend, a carbon budget tells us just how much more carbon humankind can release without dangerously warming the planet. By knowing how much carbon is being released by natural sources and by knowing our total CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions, we can know just how much or how little is left in our carbon budget.
If we end up finding out that, climate warming is actually emitting a lot of methane from thawing permafrost, then this means that we really have to cut down even more on our emissions. So that's why it's important to really understand the processes, what's driving these things.
Although I've come to Karasjok in the summer, such as it is, Hannah comes here year-round to measure emissions. That's important because scientists and climate modelers have assumed that when it's winter time and the permafrost is frozen from the surface down, it's not really emitting greenhouse gases. One thing you need to know about permafrost is that there's a layer over the top of it that's called the active layer because it thaws some in the summer and then refreezes in the winter. Scientists and climate modelers have assumed when permafrost is frozen and when that active layer is frozen, it's not really emitting greenhouse gases. But it's more nuanced than that. Hannah explains.
So we came out here in March. Everything was covered in snow. And we dug up the snow, like about 50 centimeter to 1 meter of snow to take measurements here. And then I was expecting, oh, nothing is going to happen. It's going to be no emissions, no activity. But then there was huge amounts of methane that's just pumping out. And I was so shocked.
Other researchers have found that permafrost can release lots more CO2 in the late fall and early winter than was previously thought. Because a warmer climate means it takes the active layer longer to refreeze than it used to. Many of these studies are done using remote sensing, like satellite imagery, to gather information. Far fewer measurements are done out in the field, like with Hannah's research. And being in the field enabled Hannah to see what was happening at a time when most people believed emissions would be next to nothing. So, what's going on? The key is one type of vegetation that commonly grows in these areas, called sedges. Sedges look like grasses, but have a different structure.
The sedges have this straw structure. Then it's really just pumping, transporting methane that's in the deeper part of soil all the way into the atmosphere very, very quickly.
Hannah says this process can go on year-round because even when the surface of the pond is frozen, it can remain thawed deep below.
And then when it's not frozen, then the microbes are still active. It's very cold, and so the microbes are not very active. But just imagine winter is half of the year is frozen in this landscape. And so methane is continuously being produced over the winter. And if the soil surface was frozen, then it would not be transporting all of this methane to the atmosphere. But since this straw structure is there, and it's kind of going all the way through the ice layer, then what is likely happening is that all of this methane that's produced over the winter in the deeper part of soil is then just transported out to the atmosphere.
How important this mechanism is in the big picture remains to be determined, but it could be quite significant. And here's another thing. Remember what I said about researchers needing a time machine? This site is exactly that. Different areas of this field site represent different times in the life of a pulsar.
So we don't have to wait 200 years for the bog to, or the vegetation to grow back, but we just find a natural succession area and assume that 200 years from permafrost thawing event, the environment could, or most likely will turn into that kind of environment, and we substitute space for time. So this natural gradient is very interesting because we don't have to wait 200 years to understand what's going to happen.
Some areas have big healthy pulses, big bumps with ice cores in their centers. Elsewhere, there are pulses that are beginning to thaw. Those are the big ugly peat mounds with cracks across them. And then, once the ice core inside the pulsa has completely thawed, the pulsa collapses and leaves a depression, which fills with water.
When permafrost thaws and then the land surface collapses, then it ends up becoming like a pond and a bog. And There's standing water table for long periods of time. And then after 100 or 200 years from permafrost thawing and land surface collapsing, then vegetation starts to regrow in these places. But not all vegetation grows. So the first thing that grows in this like boggy area are not even plants, they are mosses like sphagnum. So sphagnum mosses start to grow, and it start to sphagnums start to fill in the pond and the bog, and then it starts to create this very thick organic layer within the pond, and it starts to fill in the pond. And then when the soil gets, then when the surface gets dried enough, then it starts to grow this grass-looking plants called sedges.
Yes, the sedges again. Remember, the sedges were the big surprise for Hannah. Those are the straws that are pumping methane out from the bogs in the winter. There's still a lot to be learned.
But as time goes by, these ponds and lakes can dry up. And then it might actually transition towards back to aerobic environment.
Aerobic means that there is oxygen. Most plants and animals like us, for example, like to live in a place where there's oxygen. So if the soil or peat is dry, the microbes in the soil will release CO2 as part of the decomposition process.
Under aerobic conditions, then methane emissions may not be so important, or there may not be so much methane emissions from compared to how much methane was emitted during this early thaw period.
You can see that the situation is very complex. That's all the more reason that researchers like Hannah need to collect this information now. But what does it actually take to measure all of this information? Earlier, I described the landscape itself, but I didn't describe all of the scientific equipment, and there's a lot of it. There's pipes sunk into the ground to measure ground temperatures, bright orange flags marking different areas where the researchers measure greenhouse gas emissions every time they come out to the field site. And then there are these open-top hexagonal plexiglass chambers, which look like little greenhouses, which is actually what they are, as Hannah explains. Unfortunately, it was really windy when I recorded this little piece of tape, so you'll have to listen carefully. Remember, 2 degrees C is kind of the magic number here, because that's what was named in the 2015 Paris Agreement as a goal. To quote the EU, the Paris Agreement sets out a global framework to avoid dangerous climate change by limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees C and pursuing efforts to limit it to 1.5 degrees C. When I'm out with the researchers in June, one of the most important activities is actually measuring the amount of greenhouse gases being released by the different areas in the field site. Remember, they've selected this site as a kind of time machine. So the different areas where they measure, on a melting palsa, in a bog area with sedges, in a healthy palsa, can give us an idea of how the greenhouse gas emissions will change as the permafrost and the pulsars thaw. One of the researchers who is out in the field with Hanna is...
My name is Anja Graszkowiak and I'm a PhD student at NTNU. I measure gas emissions from different plots, which are representing a time scale of permafrost degradation. And we correlate the emissions to the stages of the degradation. And I personally would like to connect those emissions to the surface of the ground to make it recognizable from space, from satellites.
By collecting actual emissions information from the field and connecting it to satellite information from the same time, researchers wouldn't need to go out in the field to get this data. In the future, they could look at satellite information they've gotten at this future time and compare it to satellite information taken when the researchers actually collected emissions information. Anja says this is the first step.
It's a lot of effort to bring people to the field. It costs a lot of money and those things, but I feel like you have to be out here to make estimations about this plot. Only like, okay, I will do also, or I will look at data from space, but I have to see like how big are those mounds, how deep are those ponds, how big are those ponds to make decisions about the data I want to use. And for that, I need to see it.
In this case, Anja gets to see it up close. When I'm out in the field with them, Anja and Lisa Van Solt, who you heard from at the top of the podcast, spent much of the day taking measurements in different parts of the field site. Some parts are dry and some not so much.
Describe where you're standing right now for people who couldn't see where you are.
I stand on a very wobbly floating plank in the middle of a thaw pond. While balancing on very unstable planks.
In fact, one of the first things I did when I arrived in northern Norway was to go with Hanna to a building materials store to buy more planks. The researchers are always having to build small bog boardwalks as the site changes and more permafrost melts. Anja makes the measurements using a machine called a LIGHTCOR, which we'll hear about in a bit, and calls them out to Lisa.
866.8.
Whoa.
And all the while concentrating not to drop anything into the pond.
Lisa explains to me what they're doing as Anja waits for the machine to be ready.
We have a airtight see-through chamber which captures all the gas release that an ecosystem produces. And then the air gets sucked into this machine, which then tells us the amount of CO2, methane, and water that is in our chamber. And we're also measuring the photosynthetic rate by measuring the PAR, which is photosynthetic activity radiation. It's just how intense the sun is, basically. The higher the better, because like then vegetation will work harder, and now you'll see there's more effect. And we're also looking at the moisture, but this plot is wet, so moisture is 100, but with like the other ones, the dry ones, we also measure moisture content in the soil, but not here. It's not really necessary.
This measurement is really critical and hinges on that machine I mentioned earlier, a portable gas analyzer called the LIGHTCOR, after the name of the company that manufactures the equipment. One thing you need to know about this machine is that it costs a lot of money. And the only people who can fix it are the manufacturers, based in Lincoln, Nebraska, in the United States.
You have to be really careful that no water, absolutely no water, goes into the Lycor.
Yeah, if water comes in here, we're
done for the year.
For the year, yeah.
Then it has to go back to the manufacturer, to the US.
As the field season goes on, the access to all the areas where they make measurements gets trickier and trickier.
More often you come, like every day, everything gets a bit like worse. It gets wetter, the planks get more unstable because several people walk over it back and forth, and that makes the underground layer even softer, and then becomes more and more challenging.
Is this really what you thought you wanted to do when you signed up for?
I was told there are no bears.
In case you couldn't guess, Anya's a little uncomfortable about bears. She's happy.
And I mean, there are no bears.
That's true.
It's true.
Yeah.
There's lots of water, though.
You can hear that Anya and the rest of the crew are having fun in this beautiful, cold, wet, windy landscape. But they are also all driven to help us tackle climate change. Anya explains her piece of the puzzle and why it matters.
In a lot of carbon budgets, carbon estimations, the permafrost emissions are not that well represented. So when we estimate, or when other scientists estimate the temperatures in the future, they work with emission budgets. They say, okay, if we keep emitting like that, it's going to be so and so many degrees warmer. Or if we stop emitting, if we would even actively bind carbon from the atmosphere somehow, we would end up with that and that temperature. And for that, we need to know, our budget or the planet's budget. And only if all the emissions are correctly captured, we're able to estimate those things. So, yes, this is why I think everyone who lives on this really beautiful planet should care about what the thawing permafrost is emitting.
But what about Daniel Serrano, the intrepid researcher waiting around in the bog with a trowel and two kinds of tea bags? Daniel was a bachelor's student at the time, and this piece of research was central to his bachelor's project.
I'm studying a degree in biology in Madrid, in my home city. And I'm here as an exchange program doing my thesis with Hannah. It's kind of similar to the bachelor thesis that you have here.
And the tea bags?
This is about measuring the decomposition rate of the permafrost. And it's very special because of this unique site that we have here. But basically, what I'm doing is with a simple, really simple method that is using tea bags, the same as you can have in your house, or Lipton tea bags, green tea and rooibos, exactly. And they are simulating dead plant material, so they are going to be decomposed as other plants. And we are measuring this decomposition at the end of the season, and we are going to relate that with the thaw of the permafrost, and we are going to see probably that the areas with more thaw are going to have this higher rates of decomposition.
Who knew that tea bags could give us insights into global climate change? I'm Nancy Basilchuk, and you've been listening to 63 Degrees North, an original podcast from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. My guests on today's episode were Hannah Lee, Anya Kreshkoviak, Lisa Von Salt, and Daniel Serrano. If you want to know more about the research discussed in this episode, check out our show notes. And if you've enjoyed today's show, tell your friends and leave us a review. Sound design and editorial help from Historia Bruke. Thanks for listening.